back. Miss Vianne, please settle. We have to be patient and wait for you because there are just about three of us or four in this room that don't have a luxury of walking up at any time. So we only need a break to do. So we can't start without you. So I hope you're now ready to proceed.
Yes, I am. I apologize.
Okay. Continue sipping your tea. That's fine. Over to you, Advocate Mpofu.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you so much, Chair. Yes, just wanted to round off the issue that we were discussing before the break. You had established the efforts that you had taken in order to trace Mr. Van Lochenberg, starting from his previous employer and then following on that lead, and then Mr. Linda going again the following day and so on. But I now want to ask you two related aspects. One is, and that's really what is relevant for the committee here. Of the people in the team, and I'm now talking about the team investigator, chief investigator, executive manager, public protector, can even throw in the deputy public protector if you like. Of those people, whose responsibility was it, or is it usually, to serve subpoenas or to make sure that they are served?
The investigation team.
And that means who and who and who? In this case?
In this case, it would have been me, Mr. Matabuhle, and Mr. Linda.
Yes.
Well, Mr. Linda, though, did not form of the part of the team. He was just providing a service for the
team. In other words, Mr. Linda, either at your request or Mr. Matabu.
Yes.
But, okay, let me put it this way, without being condescending. I'm not concerned about anyone who is below Mr. Matabu.
Okay.
So I'm saying, okay. Above Mr. Matabuhle, is there anyone who would be responsible for the service of such subpoenas?
No, they wouldn't. We would just brief them that we're having difficulty or challenges, but they won't get involved in communicating with David, instructing David, etc. David being Mr. Linderson.
Yes. And now let's stop beating about the bush. The accusation in this inquiry is that the public protector, A, was involved in this tracing or tracking exercise, and B, even worse, was also involved in the deliberate effort not to serve the subpoena. Is that even possible?
No, she is not responsible for tracing an individual that has been identified during an investigation that's done by the investigation team. We are the ones, like if I'm making an example from what I said previously, if we know that a certain investigator dealt with a Opa Makashulen issue or an allegation that related to him, I would approach, or Mr. Matabuhle would approach that investigator, hey, do you have this guy's email address, etc. So public protector would not get involved in that. In relation to the deliberate that PP would have deliberately not served Mr. Van Lochenberg, it's not possible for either of us to deliberately do that.
Yeah.
What would the motive have been? Okay, PP is non-existent, but I take offense to that allegation, actually.
Yes. Yes, no, I accept that. And I suppose that's a variation of the same theme, because for that to happen, you would have to be party to that deliberate non-service.
Yeah, deliberate.
Yes.
Non-service, yes.
Yeah. And can you tell this committee in no uncertain terms whether you or anyone that you know was ever party to a deliberate non-service to Mr. Van Lochenberg?
No, definitely not.
Thank you. And just to make this abundantly clear, and please excuse me for the example I'm going to make. Let's assume you or Mr. Linda or Mr. Matabuch, the three people that you have mentioned. Maybe it's easier for Mr. Linda. Let's assume you gave Mr. Linda the instruction, and then Mr. Linda, instead of taking the subpoena, went to, and I hope he'll excuse me as well, went to some shebeen or tavern and decided to throw the whole thing into the dustbin. And therefore, Mr. Van Lochenberg was not traced for that reason. Is there anything that the public protector would have done, or could she even have known if Mr. Linda decided to do such a thing?
No, unless informed by Mr. Linda's manager.
Yeah.
If they had discovered that, because now it would have to go, it would be reported to his superior that take the decision. Yeah. Now it's a whole, HR issue.
Yeah.
The evidence of that would have been where? Yeah. Unless someone saw him putting it into the bin.
Yeah. All right. No, it's fine. Just asking that for emphasis. And maybe let me put it like this. Once you or Mr. Matabuche informed the public protector that you had done everything in your power to trace Mr. Van Lochenberg and failed, was she entitled to take your word for it, that you have done whatever efforts were needed to be done?
Yes.
Thank you. All right. Thank you. All right. Now, let's then go to yes, thank you. Okay, just got a note for the sake of completion so that we don't come back to this. It has been suggested, all sorts of things have been suggested. You know, hindsight, as they say, is an exact science. All of us sitting here will be clever now because we were not in that space. It has been suggested that you should have done tracing through Facebook or social media and the internet. Did you consult the internet?
Yes, Google.
You Googled yourself?
Yes, myself. To try, and even before we approached the whistleblower from SARS, that was the first point, to find out if he had a more recent employment, etc. So that was Google. Unfortunately, we don't have access, or didn't have access. I don't believe we even still get it for Facebook and YouTube at the office. Okay. So the server doesn't allow those kind of
applications,
such as even LinkedIn, because LinkedIn is the more professional body of that, yes.
All right. Um, And I think Mr. Matabuge also brought another insight into this, in the sense that it's also been suggested that he should have been traced via some letter that came from his attorneys in June 2019. And Mr. Matabuge's evidence, if I'm not misrepresenting it, was that the tracing effort had been done in April already, and you had already given up and decided to proceed with the investigation on the understanding that Mr. Van Lochenberg could not be traced. So by the time there was this June letter, the horse had already bolted. Can you try and explain that in terms of, you know, the timeline of the investigation? Could it have been that he would have been traced in June, and what would have then that meant in terms of the sequencing?
On the 5th, I think the letter is the 5th of June, if I'm not mistaken. Just like to state that I've never seen that letter.
Yes.
It was not sent to me. I have no involvement in it. But at that point in June, the Section 7-9 had been issued. Besides the fact that the Section 7-9 had been issued, when we sat as a team to discuss what really Mr. Van Lochenberg was required for, or was required to answer on, which were the allegations specifically of maladministration and improper conduct, Mr. Van Lochenberg, if I can use the word role player again, wasn't a decision maker in any of the allegations or the findings that we were going to make or potentially make. And he wouldn't have been impacted as well on the remedial action that was going to be taken, specifically by SARS in relation to trying to resolve any issues or systematic things that we had identified during the investigation. So our viewpoint was that then, since Mr. Van Lochenberg's allegations relating to him specifically, directly, which were the allegations that he had received funds into his personal account, were to be dealt with in issue 2. And that's when we would now restart the process of vigorously trying to locate him. So at that point, at June, Section 7-9 is issued. No findings are being made against Mr. Van Lochenberg. His letter, I'm not sure what the letter said specifically. We were now in the process of collating all the information we have gathered. So I wouldn't know what would I have done now if I had seen the letter at that time. But I can't comment on something that did not happen. Yeah.
Thank you. So just to put the matter beyond any doubt, is there any basis for alleging that the public protector was responsible, or anybody or yourself was responsible for the deliberate non-service of Mr. Van Lochenberg's subpoena?
No, but everyone has a right to an opinion.
Yes. And yeah, but we're interested in the facts.
Yes.
Well, we should be. I can vouch that we are. As a matter of fact, was there any deliberate non-service on Mr. Van Lochenberg?
No.
Thank you. Right. Okay. Now we can then go to where I wanted us to go for this session, which is page 6245, I think of the same bundle. It's the 79 notice, Chapa, if you can find it, 6245.
Yes, you what you want? Page number?
6245.
Oh, I suppose a bit slow today.
Unlike her. No, sorry, I think I've misled you. This is all right, maybe you can help me.
Bundle, is that what you're asking? Okay,
there can be many 6245. Yeah,
or just explain what it is. Then
okay,
they can
yes, it's the section. No, wait. This is the Section 79 notice for Mr. Hillay. I'm told that the same thing appears in bundle 8, 6472.
Check, is that the one? Just check on the screen.
Yes. Sorry. What's the date of that? Okay, just go to kindly da 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 da. Yeah. That's the document. Okay, I'll just use this for practical purposes. There's a similar one for Mr. Godin, but they're more or less the same. This will be sufficient to make the points I want to make. Okay, let's just use this. You can confirm that you sent similarly worded Section 79 notices to Mr. Pillay and Mr. Godin, as far as the background and all that is concerned, correct?
Correct. Mr. Pillay's and Mr. Makashule's would not have had the EMEA issue.
Yes, except for that. And I'll do the cross-referencing for the committee. Apologize, Chair, but I just want to use the one that I've underlined here. All right. Now, this is 5172. Okay, I'm told Mr. Godin's one is 5172, just for reference purposes. But I'm going to use this one. All right. Now, these documents, the seven nines, I must say this as a, by way of preface. For me, this is the biggest sign that this was a thorough investigation, because quite frankly, I've never written or seen many 66-page or 71-page letters. And this one to Mr. Pillay was 66 pages. What is the page number at the top, Tepo? Six, four, seven, two. Okay, that's not my numbering. Okay, that's fine. So then I'll just use the paragraph numbers. But that particular letter, Chair, just for the record, is 66 pages and signed by the public protector. It's, as I say, I've seen many letters, but not that the one that is that long. So we'll go through it. If we go through it bit by bit, we'll be here all week. So I'm just going to deal with the broad topics. So please go to the paragraph three. Right. Okay, after identifying that there was a complaint sent by Mr. Shivambu, sorry, go back to paragraph two. Identifying that there's a complaint by Mr. Shivambu and an anonymous whistleblower, and so the second complaint was lodged on the 9th of November by Mr. Fred Shivambu, the Deputy President and Chief Whip of the Economic Freedom Fighters. Then we go to paragraph three. Okay, and trying to move along very with speed, then it details the actual allegations in those complaints, correct?
Correct.
And it talks about Mr. Pillay have failed to follow proper recruitment procedures in the appointment of Mr. Yolisa Piki and Mr. Van Lochenberg.
Correct.
Right? So again, there, it's not Mr. Van Lochenberg as much who's accused of anything. He's just the subject of the accusation. It's Mr. Pillay who's being accused, correct?
Correct.
Then the next one, again, is Mr. Van Lochenberg unlawfully received cash deposits paid directly into his personal FNB account, and so on. And again, it's not like he paid anything. He received certain monies, allegedly, correct?
Yes, correct.
And the same allegation is made against Mr. Makwakwa, that he also unlawfully received cash deposit into his personal account in the same way as Mr. Van Lochenberg, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Allegedly, yeah. And then the point you made earlier, Chair, which is that during the tenure of former Commissioner SARS, Mr. Pravin Gordhan, Mr. Gordhan established an intelligence unit in violation of the intelligence prescripts, and the intelligence unit was confirmed by SARS investigation report compiled by Advocate Kakan. Was that your understanding, that the SARS investigation was actually commissioned by SARS?
No, this is the allegation. So the complainant will come and tell us that I want to complain against this, and we put it as it is.
Yes.
When we confine our own issues, we then will either confirm or not confirm whether it was Advocate Kakan who yes. were commissioned. But yes, that is the allegation, that SARS commissioned an investigation that was compiled by Advocate Kakan,
yeah.
who then confirmed.
Okay, then again, maybe just to assist the process, subject to any objection by Advocate Bauer, I think it's common cause that the Kakan investigation was indeed commissioned by SARS, specifically by Mr. Pillay. Is that what you subsequently found?
Yes.
Okay. Right. And then there was another investigation called the KPMG report, which we will also talk about. And I think it's also common cause that that was also commissioned by SARS, but this time Commissioner Moyane. Was that what you found?
I won't recall because I can't recall exactly now, Advocate Mpofu, because KPMG was in 2015, I believe. Yes, it was Mr. Moyane.
Yes, yeah. Yes, because I think he started in September 2014. All right. And then, Chair, I won't go through all those allegations, but they cover really what the witness has already spoken about, the equipment issue, bagging of offices, recruitment, what have you. up to 3.14. Then at paragraph 8, and this is an important issue. This is where the division of part 1 and part 2 is. This is by the public protector. She says, due to public interest, I have decided to focus the first part of my investigation into the following issues. The allegation that Mr. Godin violated the ethics code by deliberately misleading the National Assembly in failing to disclose that he had met with a member of the Gupta family since taking office. 8.2, the allegation that during his tenure as SARS Commissioner, Mr. Pravin Godin established an intelligence unit in violation of the South African intelligence prescripts, and SARS fails to follow to follow correct procurement processes and so on. So that would be what became the so-called rogue unit report, part 1, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And then at paragraph 9.2, paragraph 9, the following issues will be deferred to the second volume of the investigation. So that's part 2. And that, firstly, is the investigation about Mr. Van Lochenberg, as you earlier testified, correct?
Correct.
9.2 is also the investigation that Mr. Van Lochenberg received money into his FNB account. That was also to be deferred, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Mr. Makwakwa and all those things, and IT tenders of 8 billion and what have you. All that was deferred, correct?
Yes. About the IT tender. Is it on the...
Yeah, it's 9.6.
Okay.
Let's go to 9.6. So the allegation that SARS regularly extended the SARS IT tender for 12 years, resulting in fruitless and wasteful expenditure that has escalated to 8 billion to date.
Yes, correct. It's correct.
Yes.
Part 2.
Yes, that was all part 2. And then if you go to paragraph 10, it's a summary of what part 1 is. It's basically a repetition.
Yes.
So those are the 6 points of what was going to be actually investigated in. If you go to 10.1, please, support. 10.1 onwards, yeah. It's just a repetition of those issues that are in part 1.
Yes, if I can, before you continue, the point that I was making, that the allegation in the list where the complaints are listed, you remember that allegation number 2, which relates to the establishment, at the end, the complainant says that this was confirmed by the Sikakane report. In the allegation that we then convert into our issue, it's no longer there. Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. No, that's thank you very much. Yeah, I stand corrected. That's actually an important point, yeah. So you're saying that the complainant might frame it in such a way that they've already reached some conclusion.
Yes.
But when you have to frame it for yourselves, it must be as neutral as possible.
Correct.
All right. Good. So for that point, one would have to make a comparison between what is said in 3.4, which includes the Sikakane thing, and what is said in 10.2, which excludes it.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, good. Now, number 12 is then, as we explained earlier, I think to the chair and the committee, the nub of what Section 7.9 is. And I'll just read it out. It says, I have evidence indicating wrongdoing on the part of SARS and Mr. Pillay, and in the Gordhan letter, it will say Mr. Gordhan, obviously.
Yes.
Mr. Pillay or Mr. Gordhan, as a former employee of SARS regarding the allegations below, and should I not receive evidence to the contrary, I am likely to make adverse findings and take appropriate remedial action against SARS and yourself for the wrongdoing under the circumstances, mindful that you and erstwhile commissioner who may have been responsible at the time for the commission of the relevant wrongdoing is no longer at SARS. So that's the heart of this document,
yes.
As we explained earlier. If I don't get anything, remember my example about the bottle of water. If I don't get anything, I'm likely to make adverse findings against you.
Yes.
So this is your Audi opportunity.
Yes, correct.
Right. And then we come to what we call the investigation process. Then you outline to the person how you can't just say, I'm likely to make adverse findings. You then have to explain to them how that came about.
Yes,
right.
You have to.
Then the investigation chair, from 13.1, and again, I won't read everything. It says, a preliminary investigation was conducted and so on. And then to 13.1.2, a formal investigation was subsequently conducted. Number three, I received information and documentation from different sources, including whistleblowers and complainants. I also utilized documents previously submitted to me by SARS for file number 7.2 of 2012. So you identify there that you got information, you did what is called a preliminary investigation. We'll go back to what that means now. Then you had a formal investigation and that you received information from whistleblowers and various other sources.
Right? Yes, that's what it says.
Right. Now, if you can, let's pause there, because this also covers another issue that also covers the so-called HR issues. What is the first thing you do when you have an investigation of this sort? Or maybe let me put it this way, what is involved in the preliminary investigation?
It would be meeting with the complainant or complainants, as well as doing the relevant research, finding out if we haven't investigated a similar matter before. Once we establish that, and also establishing jurisdiction, of course. So that is mainly what a preliminary investigation would do. Once we then confirm that there is a possibility that the allegations have merit or that they are possibly true, we then start with the relevant institution to ask them to give us, to tell them that there are allegations made against that institution. So in this case, we wrote to SARS. Mr. Mark Kingon was the acting commissioner at the time, detailing all these allegations that are listed in this report and requested documents to support, or not to support, but to just either to refute the allegations. Yes, sorry, okay. English runs away sometimes. Or either confirm. So they are then submit either we prefer institutions to submit a formal statement, so in a form of a letter. It doesn't have to be commissioned or anything. In a form of a letter detailing the allegations, whether they deny or agree with the allegations that have been made. And then in whatever that they say, attach specific evidence. That is then the first stance. In this case, letters had to go out to the relevant parties. So that was Mr. Gordhan, Mr. President Ramaphosa, and then SARS. Those were sent, documents were received. We go through the documents, identify who needs to be interviewed, if we have to have meetings with them. If we don't understand certain things, it's not clear from the documents, we then call meetings, etc. Once all the information is collected, it's analyzed and put into paper. Now, no one knows what is going to be the end product until you finalize the analysis of the documents, because they are the ones that are going to tell you if something happened or something went wrong in whatever process that is being investigated. And those, we then put in the application of the law, what should have happened or what actually happened. So the law will tell you what should have happened. Once you analyze that against the backdrop of the evidence that you have or has been submitted, that you obtained as well, you then make a conclusion. That's how then we get to a product of either Section 7-9 or a discretionary notice, depending on the outcome of the what the conclusions say. Is that process fine, or you want me to continue?
No, it's fine. Okay. It's fine. Thank you. Just an important issue. You said that one of the most important things you do is to consult or to interview the complainant.
Yes.
Okay. That, again, I'm asking you now as an experienced investigator. You are now a senior investigator, correct?
Yes, correct.
Yes. Whether, and this is another thing that this committee and us have been at loggerheads about, is it, if the complainant is available, let's assume the complainant is not a whistleblower or someone who wants to remain anonymous, why is it so important that the complainant must? Or let me put it this way, is it possible to even proceed with your inquiry or investigation without involving the complainant, the person who actually brought us here?
Yes, it is possible. If the complainant has the complaint in his complaint form, excuse me, the allegations are clear, straightforward. They even attach supporting documents, evidence. That is, it's clear. You're not forced to meet with the complainant. It's your discretion as the investigator, right, whether or not you need further consultation. But consultation can also be done through the phone, through a telephone call. Yes. Now we even have Zoom, etc. In this particular case, if we go back to the evidence that has been presented, like the Section 7-9 states, there was a complaint received in October 2018. When you read that complaint, it's not very clear what the complainant is complaining about. So in that instance, you'd want to meet the complainant.
Right.
No?
Yeah.
I won't go into detail thereafter, because the question has not been asked.
Yes. Okay. No, that's fine. And maybe, but it's been answered in your last part. Yeah. Let me put it this way then. Yeah. Where there is, as you say, lack of clarity or ambiguity or some controversy about the complaint, who is the best person to clarify that?
If the complaint is not clear.
Yes. Let's say there's some controversy or debate or lack of clarity about what about the complaint itself. The point is mm-hmm. there anyone other than the complainant who can assist you with that?
No.
Thank you. All right. Anyway, so you then did go to the complainant in this case, and when and how did you get to have a meeting with the complainant?
I suppose Advocate Bauer.
Yeah, these two complainants can yes. clarify when Advocate Mpofu asked the question, which complainant is referring
yes.
to?
Yes. Okay. Thank you. All right. I thought I clarified it in the qualification to my question. I was saying, apart from putting aside any anonymous whistleblowers or complainant who might not be identifiable or easily identifiable, but that's fine. What Advocate Bauer is asking, you have confirmed at the beginning of this letter in paragraph 2 that there were two complaints. One was anonymous and the other one was from Mr. Shivambu, correct?
Mm-hmm. So just put it on. Sorry.
Yes, that's correct.
So when you say you met the complainant, which of the two were you referring to?
Mr. Shivambu.
Okay. Thank you. The other questions I've already asked you. So obviously you wanted clarity or more information or whatever it is. Can you just tell the committee what happened in that meeting or what was discussed?
The complaint that he had lodged was discussed. So it took us into detail about his allegations. Unfortunately, we don't have a full record.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember making notes, but I did make notes. It's just I can't find them now.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, his complaint, what his complaint was about, specifically what information he had in his possession that he could provide to us. He provided us with also names of people we can talk to for further information. Basically, that was it. It's just a prelim. It's not like we're interrogating the complainant. We are just trying to get some more information. And he was also a willing participant who wanted to give information. So it made our lives easier.
Yeah. Good for you. Well, you should come and teach us in this inquiry that the importance of the complainant. Yeah. But again, that's a story for another day. Anyway, so there's also there was a suggestion at least made to Mr. Mataboge, and I suppose that's what Advocate Bauer is alluding to, that the other complainant, the anonymous complainant, I think wrote a letter to you or an email to say that he or she was coming to South Africa in December, but the meeting with that person did not take place. Can you explain why that did not happen?
The anonymous complainant. The anonymous complainant we received in October of 2018. So this is before Mr. Shivambu arrives,
mm-hmm.
even though we didn't even know that he's coming. We receive a complaint. His complaint, if you can go through it, it's about three paragraphs.
Mm-hmm.
The first part, which was when we receive a complaint, normally we'll communicate with the complainant, informing them that, okay, the matter has been allocated to me for further investigation. In this instance, I required more information from the complainant, and I said to him, we respect the fact that you'd like to remain anonymous, but the kind of allegations you have made need more information, specifically in relation to the surveillance. The complainant was alleging surveillance of politicians and et cetera. So, and then the second allegation was that Mr. Van Lochenberg had then received personal monies into his bank account, and he listed the monies.
Mm.
The third allegation, I believe, was about Mr. Gordhan receiving monies in the United States or Canada,
uh-huh.
if I remember correctly. We then sent a complainant an email requesting that kind of interaction. He did not respond until we then received Mr. Shivambu's complaint.
Uh-huh.
He responds, okay, once we see that this complaint relates to SARS, because what happens in the public protector is that if complaints come in at almost a similar interval, then they relate to a similar institution. We will then identify what's, okay, these guys are, or these people are complaining about the same similar issue.
Right.
So the allegation, let's say Van Lochenberg receiving cash payments or cash into his personal bank account, was also contained in Mr. Shivambu's complaint. The complaint relating to surveillance or unlawful operations of the alleged unit was also in Mr. Shivambu's complaint. The decision was then taken, okay, yes, we are beginning the investigation. After meeting with Mr. Shivambu, we'll start the investigation because we've already had another complaint that's similar. So investigation proceeds, we write the letters, then we receive the email about the USA.
Mm-hmm.
The decision was taken. It was not necessary anymore. We had we'd gotten clarity of where he wanted to go, complainant.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. Okay, thank you. So in other words, you're saying the complaints were similar, or at least there was they might not have been identical, but there was overlap.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Now, then you've already explained this, what you call the formal investigation. That's when you require information from the role players.
Yes.
Sorry. Right, now then we go to paragraph 14, 65. Okay, let me not try to do the page numbers. Paragraph 14, yeah. Then you explain to the person the evidence obtained during your investigation. Remember, you said now we've done an informal preliminary investigation, we've done a formal investigation, we spoke to whistleblowers. Now you then explain to them what information you received, right?
Correct.
Now, then you put the first allegation regarding whether during his tenure as SARS commissioner, Mr. Gordhan established an intelligence unit in violation of the prescripts, whether such conduct constitutes maladministration, right? And I'll just go through that particular one, but not all the other allegations, just to show your methodology, okay?
Yes.
You start, I'll just read it out for the record. 14.1, you put, it is not in dispute that the allegations relating to the unlawful establishment of SARS intelligence unit has been one of much contention within the public arena of South Africa. The matter has been investigated and discussed by various institutions and legal experts. Various reports have been submitted to me regarding such investigations. Where did those various reports come from?
SARS.
Okay. And does that, we've already covered some of this. That would be the Sekakane, Kanyane,
KPMG,
Kruon, and then the legal opinions of various advocates. Okay, we'll come to that. Yeah. All right.
Now, while you are here, you've been accused, when I say you, okay, maybe let me establish this so that there's no confusion. While this is a letter signed by the public protector, as it should, can you explain to the committee what role you personally played in its formulation, construction, drafting, all 66 pages of it?
I was the drafter.
Uh-huh. And, well, congratulations. When you draft this 66-page letter or something of that sort, this would be now after you've done your investigation and you are at the stage as where you explained earlier, where you have possible adverse findings against somebody.
Correct.
Right. Now, so when I say you, although we know that the letter is signed by the public protector, I'm using that interchangeably, or it's a plural you. You and the public protector as the drafters or architects of this letter. All right. Now, one of the things that the public protector, including yourself in this context, has been accused of very sharply is that you did not take into account the findings of the Nugent report, Nugent Commission report, otherwise known as the Commission of Inquiry into Tax Administration and Governance report. Is that criticism valid?
No, it's not.
And did you, in fact, take into account the Nugent report?
Yes, we did. We mentioned it a couple of times and what the findings of the report were and the passing commentary that was made by the judge.
Mm-hmm.
So if we hadn't considered it, we wouldn't have even known what it says.
Yeah. And that, if you go to 14.1.4, and then I'll read you some of what is said here, and you'll then comment on whether the criticism that you ignored the Nugent report is valid. 14.1.4 says that in a response dated 5 February 2019, SARS stated that the consideration of lawfulness of an intelligence unit within SARS had generated a vast amount of comment and opinion. SARS referred me, that's the public protector or you, to the Commission of Inquiry into Tax Administration and Governance final report, specifically under the heading, the so-called rogue unit, in which it is stated. Well, firstly, let's just start with that. Another criticism by Mr. Van Lochenberg was that the public protector was the originator or was guilty of prejudging by simply referring to this thing as the so-called rogue unit. Have you ever had anyone accusing Judge Nugent of the same thing? Because his heading here is called the so-called rogue unit. And do you know where that term came from? Did it come from the public protector?
I know the rogue unit comes from media reports as far back as 2014, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
I think it was the Sunday Times that initially broke the story, if there is a story.
Yeah.
So-called, I don't know where that comes from. I think it's a term that, because there's been so much denial of the fact that the unit was rogue, people usually put so-called on front of it. Yeah. So no, it did not originate from the public protector. At the time of the response was received in February. No, we hadn't had a meeting with the public protector yet where she would have been able to refer to the so-called rogue unit.
Yeah. No, it's fine. When the public protector testified, she'll explain that actually when that term was constructed by the newspapers, she was minding her own business working in China, not even dreaming of becoming the public protector. But anyway, such is life. Anyway, so this is the point about the report that you allegedly ignored. If you go to the next page, please, Tepo. There, you quote extensively from the New Gen report. You actually quote three paragraphs from the New Gen report. Isn't that right?
Yes, it's correct.
While we are on that point, Chair, can you will come back to this paper. Just move over to 14.2.1. That's now page 26. That was page 10 of the 66-page letter. Now we're at page 26, typed page. 14.2.1. Yeah. There again, you say that SARS referred me to an extract of the SARS Commission of Inquiry, that's the New Gen report, which stated specifically regarding the alleged purchase of equipment, and then you quote the New Gen report again, you and the public protector, correct?
Correct.
Now, in the light of those, and in any event, I think since we're here, Chairperson, we might as well go to we'll come back to this. This one. Yes, just for the sake of completion. Sorry, Tepo, can you go to the report, the actual report, which is, I think in bundle, it's 4257.
You winning, Sapo? You need directions. Okay, I thought he gave you.
Yeah, I did. It's page 4257 of bundle A. It's the report. It's the so-called rogue unit report. That's at 4217 on my, yeah. Yes, thank you. Thank you, there you are. I'm just jumping all the other references to the Nguyen report. I'm now taking this to the report itself, to the so-called rogue units report. 5-2, can you go further down? Yeah. Yes, the public protector says in her report, SARS referred me to the Commission of Inquiry into Tax Administration and Governance Final Report under the heading the so-called rogue unit, in which it stated, then she quotes the Nguyen report. So is there any substance to the allegation that she ignored and did not take into account?
No, it's not correct. We obtained a copy of the report. As you can see, SARS is just referring us to paragraphs. We obtained a copy of the actual report to confirm that what SARS is quoting here is correct. So that couldn't have been done without reading the report, specifically on the issues that related to the rogue unit, because there were a lot of things the Nguyen report went into. So this is how we then considered it.
All right. Let's just pause there then to deal with something very central to this whole saga. And that is the point that you make in the report, or rather that the public protector makes in the Section 7-9 notice that you drafted. Where you say various reports the matter has been one of much contention within the public arena in South Africa. The matter has been investigated and discussed by various institutions and legal experts. Various reports have been submitted to me regarding such investigations. Now, it's common cause that those reports include the Skakane report, the KPMG report, the Kruen report, and so on and so on. The allegation that is made against the public protector, and this also comes out from the judgment, is that the public protector relied on these other reports. Apart from this kind of remark which she makes by way of background that there have been various other institutions and what have you. In other words, it is suggested that she literally almost transplanted information from those reports, regurgitated it into her report, and ignored the fact that those reports had been quote-unquote widely discredited. I don't know by whom. Is that a fact? Is that what you did in actual fact?
No, that is not correct.
What role?
Just as a background, we, in investigations, when we write to, even if it wasn't SARS, another institution altogether, in some instances, you'll find that they've already conducted a forensic report or a forensic investigation. That is submitted to us. We don't then take that report and copy and paste and put it in our report. That's why we also request evidence. In instances, we'd even request the annexures that led to that particular forensic investigation company coming to that conclusion. So it is false. It's not how we work. It's not how we draft our reports. Thank you.
Thank you. And this theory goes further to say that not only did you regurgitate or blindly rely on these reports, you also ignored the fact that they had been discredited. Are you aware of any discrediting of these reports?
No, I'm not. The only one that I am aware through media was the KPMG dilemma that they experienced.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that it is either credited or discredited doesn't stop the report from existing.
Right. Now, let's just test some of what is said glibly out there about this report. Maybe let me start with this Kakane report. Are you aware of any institution, court that dealt with or reviewed this Kakane report frontally and found it to be invalid?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
All right. And it's widely believed, at least it's been bandied about here, that Justice Nugent at least was one of those sources of the discrediting of the report. Let me just take you to the actual fact. Let's go to the quotation. Let's go back to the letter. I think it's easier that way. Let's go back to the letter. Sorry, go to paragraph, where we were, paragraph 14.1.4. The quotation further down. Okay, it's not nicely legible, but I think we can make do here. Yeah. Thank you, Sean. This is what all that Justice Nugent said, and it's called discrediting the report. He says about the rogue unit, alleged. Why such a unit was considered to be unlawful is not clear to me. So he says it's not clear to him, okay? And then it says, while the National Strategic Intelligence Act prohibits the covert gathering of certain intelligence, that applies to intelligence concerning threats to the safety of the state, which hardly applies to the intelligence relevant to collecting texts. Okay. And then here's the part where he is said to be discrediting the finding, but actually, in my view, he confirms it. He says that members of the unit might have at times have acted unlawfully, that SARS employment policies might have been breached, that members might unlawfully have acquired the use of equipment, all of which came later to be alleged. I see no reason why SARS was and is not entitled to establish and operate a unit to gather intelligence on the illicit trades, even covertly within limits. Okay, let's unpack what Justice Nugent is actually saying. So he says that, firstly, the last part you've already agreed with earlier. There's no reason why SARS is not entitled to establish and operate a unit to gather intelligence on illicit trades, even covertly within limits. We all agree on that, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. But it's what he says before that which is important, which everyone ignores deliberately. And that would have been the focus of your investigation. It's not something you just brush aside. Let's assume that he's right, that members of the unit might have at times acted unlawfully. SARS employment policies might have been breached. Members might unlawfully have acquired the use of equipment. Would that be sufficient for the public protector to find maladministration?
If evidence shows that the might, the might is where we come in because,
No, forget the might. I'm saying if that was established, that at times the members acted unlawfully, SARS employment policies have been breached, and members acquired the use of equipment unlawfully. Would that be sufficient for the purposes of the public protector to make an adverse finding of maladministration?
Yes, supported by evidence, of course.
Yes, okay. Now, and to your knowledge, did the Sikakane report, the KPMG report, and all these other reports find that the establishment, let's confine it to that for now, of the unit was lawful or unlawful?
And they found that it was unlawful, the establishment.
Yes. And in fairness to Justice Nugent, he then goes on to say at paragraph 11, just go further down. Yeah. Again, this is another statement whose impact is widely exaggerated. It says, it was said to be unlawful by a panel chaired by Advocate Kakane, but I find nothing in its report to persuade me why that was so. So he, again, he expresses his opinion. And then he says, Advocate Kakane was asked if he could elaborate on his reply and took it no further than what was said in the report. And then it comes to the Cruen report. It says that, before we do that, just on this Kakane report, if, let's say, Kakane found that this thing is red and George Nugent found that it's blue, as the public protector, did you have the means to say that the Nugent report is more superior to that of Sikakane, or did you regard all of them in the same light?
They're all in the same light with respect to the public protector's investigation.
And of course, you take them into account, but would you regard any one of them to be binding on your own outcome?
No, even on our investigation.
Yes. Okay. Well, then we...
We'll pause there. Unless you want 3 minutes.
Just so that I introduce the next topic. Thank you, Sean. I'll try and move on this one fast. The other one is the Cruen report before we go to KPMG. We'll do KPMG when we come back. The Cruen report, its common cause was a panel, I think, of 7 members. And it also found the unit to have been unlawful. Now, this is what Justice Nugent says about that. Continuing there, the SARS advisory board chaired by Judge Cruen reported to the minister and issued a media statement saying the unit was unlawful. But in evidence, he told the commission that what a conclusion reached independently by the board but had been adopted from the Sikakane panel. And he came to realize it was wrong. Indeed, he supported the re-establishment of capacity to investigate illicit trade which we recommend, yeah. So again, it's I don't want to say deliberate, it's a conflation of the goodness or otherwise of the establishing a unit from its activities. But apart from Judge Gruen himself expressing a view about the findings, are you aware of any of the other six members of that panel expressing a view that they had changed their mind?
No.
Right. Okay, then we'll go to KPMG after lunch. But
maybe so that I don't break it for you, we'll break it 4:15.
Thank you, Chan. Thank you so much.
So yes. You can go to KPMG.
Yes, thank you. Yes, then after lunch we'll start with the IGI report. Thank you. Okay, so very quickly, okay, Chair, I'm not misleading you, but I'll go back to Skakan. can you go to bundle A, page 4681, paragraph 188, just so that we don't have to come back to this report.
What are you asking?
Bundle A, page 4681, paragraph 188.
Did you get it, Seppo? Yeah.
Yeah. All right. The Chair, I'm just making sure that I don't go back to this report here. These are the findings of Sikakane that we just discussed. I'll read it quickly, Chair, for the sake of progress. At paragraph 188.1, he says, they say, and by the way, these are three advocates, independent advocates, Advocate Sikakane, Advocate Rajab Badlander, and Advocate Ramano. They say, the establishment of the unit without having the requisite statutory authority was indeed unlawful. And then at two, they say there is prima facie evidence that the unit may have abused its powers and resources by engaging in activities that reside in other agencies of government. And then if you go jump to 188.5. Says, there is prima facie evidence suggesting that the activities of the Special Projects Unit may have included rogue behavior that had the potential to damage the reputation of SARS as an organ of state. Hence, after that, it was called the rogue unit, not by the public protector who was in China, but by those three advocates. You remember that?
Yes, I remember reading it.
Yes, reading it, yeah. And then if you go to page 4617, Chair, that's paragraph 56. Yeah, this is another important finding of Advocate Kakane now to do with Mr. Godin. Yeah, just look at the last sentence where it seems It seems from the memorandum that Mr. Godin had an undertaking from NIA that it was willing to accommodate such a unit. It follows even on SAR's own version, that unless NIA cooperated, the establishment of such a unit would be an illegality. You remember reading that?
Yes, I do.
Yes. So, and just to round that up, your own findings were that Mr. Godin must have been involved in the establishment, also based on the memorandum that he wrote to Mr. Trevor Manuel, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right, we'll come to that after lunch, and I just wanted, I don't want to jump to that now. Chair, this is the part which I wanted to get to before lunch. These are now the findings of KPMG. No. I said I'll do KPMG after lunch. Yeah.
We changed that, remember?
Oh, okay. Fine. We can do it now. Yeah, so that we do IGI. All right. Then go to, please, page 5084, Tepo, bundle A, paragraph 12. 5084. Right, thank you. So these are the findings of, just a minute. Yeah, paragraph 12 says executive findings and conclusions. This is now KPMG. And it says, under the guidance of Pillay, a covert and rogue intelligence unit, in contravention of the rule of law, was established in SAS. Remember that?
Yes.
And then 12.1.3, says this unit was established by Pillay at the time when Godin was commissioner of SARS. We found no evidence that Godin was informed of the existence of the unit. However, considering his position as accounting officer, it is reasonable to expect that he ought to have known of the existence of the unit. Remember that?
Yes, I think I do.
Yes. Now, is it correct that your findings were similar to these? In other words, your findings were that given the letter to Mr. Manuel, given the history, the evidence available, the idea that Mr. Godin was oblivious of the establishment of this union, or rather of this unit, was just unsustainable.
Yes, seeing that Mr. Godin drafted the memo or was the approver of the memo as the commissioner of SARS, the memo to Mr. Manuel.
Yeah.
It's impossible that he didn't know. The memo details that we would like to create a unit. The unit will undertake specific kinds of investigations,
mm-hmm.
and he then signs the memo. So how would he not have known that there is a unit?
Okay, and I don't want to stretch the chairperson's patience, but I just want us to end this that part on what that memo actually says. Chair, if you just indulge me for 2 minutes. All right, that memo is referred to in your letter, but I'm looking for the, okay, let me paraphrase this, we'll do it after lunch. Is it correct that in the memorandum drafted by Mr. Godin, he himself says that when he writes to Mr. Manuel, please approve of the establishment of this unit within NIA, because the SARS does not have the legal power or the legal mandate to establish such a unit.
Yes, in summary.
Yes. Can go to bundle A, page 4370. I promise you that's the last reference I'm making. 4370. The same series, 4370. Ooh. Okay, let's try and read this together. This is a letter written by Mr. Godin to Minister Manuel when he was the Commissioner for SARS. Okay. One, the purpose is to seek approval to find a special capability within NIA to supply SARS and law enforcement with the necessary information to address the illicit economy. Move. Two, collecting, this is the important part, collecting tactical intelligence invariably, okay, invariably means penetrating and intercepting organized criminal syndicates. You see that?
Yes.
And the whole part of this whole controversy is whether or not there was a need to do interception, in which case it would be illegal, or there was no interception, in which case it would just be some normal operation. Remember that?
Yes.
So he makes it clear that what he's asking for is something that will invariably mean penetrating and intercepting organized crime syndicates. And then he says, this is the punchline. This is an activity to which SARS does not presently have the capacity, including the legislative mandate to manage.
Capability.
I'm sorry?
The capability.
Capability, yes. Thank you, Chair. They have the capability, including the legislative mandate, to manage clandestine activity. And then he says, discussions are taking place with National Intelligence Agency to supplement SARS intelligence capability and so on. And the point I'm making is that by Mr. Godin's own hand, the unit was not, would not be legally, could not be legally established within SARS, correct?
Yes, correct. That's what the memo says.
Yes. Mm. And yet, we know that, in fact, just go towards the end, to the approval part. Yes, it's signed by Mr. Godin, Commissioner of SARS, 2007, the 9th of February. Go further down. Yeah, further up. Okay, no, that's fine. Sorry, I misled you. There, yeah. So Minister Manuel approves. The deputy minister, Chabumulekechi, also approves, but he puts a rider. He says supported. However, this is a strange way of executing what I consider to be an economic mandate of NIA. If such is through whatever, it is an add-on rather than part of NIA's mandate. Okay, but he approves it subject to that. You see that?
Yes, I do.
Yes. Now, when we come back from lunch, I will then take you through to show this committee and everyone else that actually, after what Mr. Godin says, NIA lost appetite of that joint venture that was envisaged there. They then somehow decided to just have that very illegal activity and have that unit now operating within SARS, which is what you and the public protector found. But can we deal with that when we come back? Thanks, John.
Okay. Thank you. We'll pause for lunch for 45 minutes, back at 2:10. Thank you.